It's about how we treat human beings and why people would leave their countries and risk their lives, why a mother would take her daughter, her children, and embark on this perilous journey in the Mediterranean, you know, risking everything, risking the lives of her children. No mother would do that, you know, unless there's a reason that's beyond her powers, beyond her control. Except what she's escaping is actually worse than death itself.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the Open Book podcast series, where we bring you fascinating and important conversations between local and international authors. We couldn't present a physical festival this year, but we wanted to give you a small sample of what the festival does best. Conversations between writers that give us insight not only to literature, but also into the world around us. We will be releasing 8 such conversations over the next 4 weeks. I'm Fasti Carlitz, and I will be listening to these conversations with you. We kick off our first episode with Helen Habila, a Nigerian writer and scholar living in the United States. He was the second winner of the Kane Prize and won the Wyndham Campbell Literature Prize in 2015. This conversation is about his most recent book, Travelers. In this novel, an unnamed narrator is a Nigerian doing a PhD while living in Berlin, and there he encounters various migrants and their stories. These stories are based on encounters and interviews Helen had done himself with migrants in Berlin. In conversation with Helon is Bongani Corner, a Cape Town-based writer and editor. Those of you who have attended Open Book over the years will notice that this is quite different to what we usually present at the festival. Instead of a panel discussion in front of a live audience, this is a one-on-one conversation between Helon and Bongani, coming to you from their living rooms. When I listened to this, I found this such a gentle and informative conversation, and it left me feeling quite moved. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. Here's their conversation.
Thanks for joining us, Helon. And how are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me.
I thought before we get into the book specifically, I thought I'd ask you about the Booker Prize shortlist. The two novels by writers from the continent, Tsitsi Dangarembga's This Mournable Body, Maza Mengistu's The Shadow King. And you're a writer yourself, but you're also a scholar of African literature. And so I thought maybe I could just ask you about this moment. What do you think it signifies? What does it mean?
Well, it's amazing. I'm ecstatic. It's long overdue, especially after last year, you know, when Bernadine had to share the Booker with another writer. Not that the other writer, you know, wasn't qualified, but it kind of stole away the shine from Bernadine's win. So I hope this year that at least one of them, you know, get it. And even if they don't get it, getting shortlisted, it's such a huge thing, especially for female writers from Africa. And it's not just because they're Africans or they're female or whatever. These are excellent books. I've read both books. Actually, I had the opportunity to interview, to have a discussion with Maza Mengistu when the book came out here. So I've read it and I've talked to her. I know her very well. Actually, we have the same publisher here in America. And Tsitsi, of course, is an old friend. I'm a big fan of her. So this well, you know, deserved shortlist is, and I hope that this is going to be a moment, you know, for African writing, and people are going to read these books and discover what African literature is all about.
And of course, your book as well is a fantastic addition to the canon of African literature. But before we get to the book itself, I thought I would also, we're in an unusual time, I guess, or this year in particular has been an unusual year. And I wanted to ask you about maybe the last 8 or 9 months. How has that been for you? How has that been for your family?
Yeah, 2020 has been, it still is, you know, a very weird, unusual year. So it's been strange. First of all, one is happy just to be alive. Many have died because of COVID and due to no fault of theirs. It's just like this monster outside just waiting for you to step out and it's going to catch you. So there's been fear, there's been, we've been stir crazy, staying indoors, especially the kids. We have to do all the homework with them. Now I'm teaching online. So all of us kind of have to adjust, you know, kind of in mid-stride. But as a writer, I think we're doing this now. I'm supposed to be in South Africa doing open book, but now we have to do it online. I've done a lot of festivals online just from my room. And I keep wondering how this is affecting writing itself, how it's affecting writers. I know it's affected me psychologically. There's a feeling of kind of claustrophobia. I've been indoors. I've never been in one place since I was a toddler, you know, in like this long, about 7 months. I have not traveled. So usually as a writer, you write a book all alone in your room. And then after it's out, you go and meet your audience and you get that feedback from them. You have that interaction, that love. And that's really a good thing. It kind of relieves the loneliness and the isolation. But now it's just a continuous thing. You write the book by yourself and now you're discussing the book still in the same room that you wrote the book in. So it's a kind of crazy feeling. But like I said at the beginning, we're just lucky to be alive. And we're kind of grateful for that. We just have to continue.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. You had said earlier in your response that this is the longest time that you've been in one place, 7 months, and your new novel is titled The Travelers. And you yourself are a traveler. And I just wanted to know if perhaps you could just share a little bit of your own journey, your writing journey and your personal journey from growing up in Nigeria, the Kane Prize win, or even your beginnings as a writer, the Kane Prize, and how you ended up in the U.S., and how much of that is infused in this book, how much of that experience of being somebody who has traveled all their life is infused in this book.
Yeah. How did I get to this point where I am now here in Virginia? It's been a long journey. And of course, the journey always begins, you know, with stories. And for me, that's really literally where it began, you know, listening to stories from my grandparents as a child growing up in Nigeria. And so there was that internal journey where you journey with the characters in the story and you're transported. And one begins to realize the power and the enchantment of stories. And from there, from listening to stories told orally, one moved to reading. I discovered books, I think, when I was around 7, 8, I was in primary school, and I was always reading. I never stopped reading, I think, since I started. I like to joke that I never stopped. And so that gave you the awareness that the world is much larger than your little town, your little family. There's much, much more outside. And I think that kind of piqued my interest, and I wanted to see more. I wanted to travel. I wanted to discover all the things that I was reading about. So from there, of course, I went to university, started writing, started imitating the authors I was reading. The big moment came for me when, you know, I finished university and I was teaching in a small town in northern Nigeria called Bauchi. I was a lecturer in a polytechnic. I realized that I couldn't be the kind of writer I wanted to be in that town. I had to leave. I had to move to Lagos because Lagos is this crazy big capital city of Nigeria. And this was 1999. Just the dictatorship in Nigeria was about to end and we're entering the democratic era. But still that cloud of the dictatorship was still looming over us. It was a terrible time. You know, I had witnessed writers being arrested, some being killed, some had to go into exile. This was the decade of brain drain for Nigeria, where a lot of intellectuals had to leave the country because if they stayed, you know, they were either killed or arrested. So that was the milieu in which I entered into writing. I moved to Lagos and I started working on my first novel, which is titled Waiting for an Angel. As you can tell from the title, it was about hope in a pessimistic time, in a difficult time. And it's the story of a young person just like me who was, you know, ambitious, wanted to become a writer, but was stifled by the circumstances around him, the anti-democratic forces around him, you know. So that was the milieu in which I emerged. First time I left my country was after I had won the Kane Prize. So that same book that I wrote in Lagos, I sent for the Kane Prize competition in England, and it luckily I was invited. I was shortlisted and invited to England. First time I was traveling outside Nigeria. I was around 30, 31. So we went to England for the Kane Prize shortlist and prize announcement. And lo and behold, I was announced the winner. So I was invited to be a fellow in England by the University of East Anglia. So that's how I left Nigeria. I didn't plan it. You know, I didn't know. I couldn't foretell that it was going to happen. It happened so fast, so quickly. So unlike other travelers, you know, who saw it coming, who aspired and planned carefully, it came suddenly without my planning. Even though I knew I wanted to travel, I desired to travel, but desiring, you know, and achieving are two different things. So for me, it happened like that. I was in England for about 5 years. I finished my fellowship for 2 years, started my PhD there, and from there, I moved to America. I was just invited by Chinua Achebe to come to America to be the first Chinua Achebe fellow. The phone just rang, and I picked up the phone and said, "I'm Chinua Achebe. Would you want to come to America and be the Chinua Achebe fellow?" And I said, "Hell yes, I would love to." So that was how I moved to America, also unplanned. And after my fellowship, I got the job where I am now, George Mason University in Virginia. So I've been here now for about 13 years, since 2007. And of course, in between, one has traveled to other places. I spent 1 year in Berlin. And of course, I'm always going back to Nigeria. So the movement, I've been an outsider, you know, I've been a stranger. And I've always had to kind of reimagine home and reinvent myself in these new places and acclimatize. It's a good thing for a writer. It's almost ideal for a writer who is, you know, an eternal outsider who is always observing things and writing and doesn't really always want to be in the center or too involved. So it's good for the writer in me, but it's really bad for the human in me who craves for family and contact and home, you know? So these are the sensibilities, I think, that I transferred to travelers as a book. You could say that my life, my travels have been part of my research when I started writing the book. So I came to it kind of prepared to write it. So that's, in a nutshell, my travels.
Thank you so much. We're going to go into the book itself proper, but I figured as a way of opening up some of the themes in the book, I wanted to refer to an essay by the late Toni Morrison titled The Foreigner's Home. I'm just going to read just two passages from it, and I'm going to ask you if it's okay, A, to respond, and then B, to those who are going to be listening who haven't read the book, to tell us what the book is about. And so this is the part from the Morrison essay. It begins like this. Excluding the height of the slave trade in the 19th century, the mass movement of peoples in the later half of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century is greater now than it has ever been. It is a movement of workers, intellectuals, refugees, armies crossing oceans, continents, immigrants through custom offices and hidden routes, speaking multiple languages of trade, of political intervention, of persecution, exile, violence, and poverty. There is little doubt that the redistribution, voluntary or involuntary, of people all over the globe tops the agenda of the state, the boardrooms, the neighborhoods, the street. Then later on, she says, the spectacle of mass movement draws our attention inevitably to the borders, the poorest places, the vulnerable points where one's concept of home is seen as being menaced by foreigners. I just thought maybe I could ask you to respond to that and then to also say a few words about the book itself, Travelers.
Yeah, it's a beautiful essay. And she's so incisive, as always. You know, it speaks to my book so much. It basically captures the idea that drove the book. There are so many ways to approach this passage, which I think you chose very carefully. You know, it's about democracy. And the failure of it, and the assumption that democracy was going to solve all our problems, you know, when our countries were formed and were handed this template of democracy, Western, you know, Western democracy. It's a kind of democracy that's unique to a certain place, and it's assumed that it's going to solve all our problems. But there are so many underlying things, you know, that you need to have before you can become democratic. Education, equality, so many things that you need to have. And you need to overcome your history in order to have that egalitarian requirement that democracy, you know, kind of entails. So all these things were not put into consideration. It was just assumed that we got independence from Britain and then we're going to become perfect democracy. And that, these are the things, you know, that people don't talk about. They talk about our countries, how they are not functioning very well. Our democracies are not working. There are wars, you know, there are riggings and all that. But then when you look at the history, you understand why this is happening. The countries were never set up to succeed. They were basically set up to fail. You know, we had divide and rule. And that mentality that pitted one part against another part is still operative. You cannot just overcome all these things and become a functioning democracy. So for me, the manifestation of this, all these things, is in the traveling that we find people doing. Because people, after colonialism came, you know, neocolonialism, the multinational corporations took over from where colonial administration stopped. So you have these powerful organizations like in the Niger Delta, oil companies who are basically stronger than governments. These companies can go and destroy your neighborhood, can take your resources and just basically reduce you to the status of servants and slaves and paupers, you know, in your own country. And what do people do? They have to leave their countries, because if they stay there, they will die. The government is not protecting them, because the government is working with the multinational corporations to get, you know, the rent that they need. And it's not just in Africa, it's all over, in India, you know, in Asia, all these countries, all the third world countries. So colonialism is still there, but in a different guise. And that's why people keep traveling. People cannot stay in their countries, because if they stay, it's almost as if you're giving them, you know, you're telling them they're going to die. So you have to understand why people travel. They are traveling because they want a better life for their children. They are traveling because democracy doesn't work. They are traveling because that's the only hope they have. It said that there are about 7 million people who are just kind of itinerant and moving around the world presently. 70 million people internationally traveling. When you think of Rohingyas, you think of the boat people, you think of some you have not even heard about. They are just there because they can't live in their countries. So it's a phenomenon, like Toni Morrison said, since the Second World War, we have not had this mass movement. It's become a feature, a defining feature of our times. And it's not going to end here. When you look at climate and how it's worsening, some countries are going to be uninhabitable, you know, in the next 30, 40 years in the Gulf areas. People cannot live in their countries because of the weather. They basically have to travel. They have to leave. So I think instead of criminalizing travel and telling people you cannot come here and reducing them to statistics and putting them in cages, like we just saw in Greece, where, you know, the camp of this vast number of people is burnt down and they have to sleep on the streets. All these images that we see are making people almost ashamed of traveling or seeking a better life. The best thing the world can do is to come together and try to reimagine and try to find a better way. You know, because the way things are, the boundaries that we set around countries and tell people that they cannot step outside these boundaries, almost as if it's a prison, we have to reimagine that. We have to reimagine national boundaries and the idea of travel itself. That's the only way we can solve this problem. And these are things that I kind of tried to talk about. Who are these people that travel? And I tried to go beyond the statistics, you know, and all the things that we read in news and all that, and show them close up. These are husbands and fathers and daughters who are compelled to travel. Some of them don't want to leave their countries. Nobody wants to leave their native home. It's the worst thing you can do. It's the hardest thing you can do, to be away from family and to go into a totally alien and strange country that's almost hostile and try to reinvent yourself and perhaps know that you might never go back to your country. So why do they do it? That's what my book, you know, tries to answer. And I kind of did it with interviews with some of these people that I met in Berlin. So almost all the characters in the book are based on actual people or actual travelers from different parts of the world. And I try to kind of reimagine their stories and fictionalize it and make it work. So that's what Travelers, I guess, is all about.
And on that note, may I ask you to read from the beginning of the book so that people get a sense of the book itself?
Okay. This is where the narrator, who is unnamed, met one of the major characters. His name is Mark. So the main character is married to an artist. Her name is Gina, and she's an American. And they're here in Berlin together because she's got a fellowship, you know, to spend 1 year painting. And she invites people to come and sit for her, to model for her. Just ordinary migrants. She's painting migrants. And one of them is Mark. And that's how the husband meets Mark when he comes to basically audition to be one of the models for her. I first met Mark when he came to the house with one of Gina's flyers in his hand. "I am here for this," he said, waving the yellow flyer. It said Gina was working on a series of portraits she called Travelers, and she was looking for real migrants to sit for her. €50 a session, to be paid for by the fellowship. I pointed him to the guest room she had converted into a studio. Soon, their voices carried to the living room, hers, polite but firm, his, questioning, arguing. He was being turned down, and I could have told him not to press. Gina would never change her mind. Later, when I asked her why, she said he wasn't right and didn't elaborate. But I guessed he looked too young. His face was too smooth and lacking the character only time and experience brings. Last week, she had drawn a lady and her 4-year-old daughter. I met the lady in the living room waiting for Gina to set up her easel, still wearing her outdoor coat, an old woolen affair. And when I asked her if she wanted me to take the coat, she shook her head. I turned to the daughter. Did she want a drink? She pulled the child closer to her. The week before that, it was a man, Manu, who told me he was a doctor in his former life. Now he worked as a bouncer in a nightclub, waiting for the result of his asylum application. His face was lined, prematurely old, and I knew Gina would love those lines, each one of them an eloquent testimony to what he had left behind, to the borders and rivers and deserts he had crossed to get to Berlin. She would also love the woman's hands that tightly clutched her daughter's arm. They were dry and scaly, the nails chipped, no doubt ruined while working in some hotel laundry or as a scullery maid. Mark came out of the studio and stood by the living room door, a wry smile on his face, his red jacket in one hand, still holding the yellow flyer in the other hand. Behind him, Gina, in her paint-splattered overalls, was already back at her painting, dabbing away at the easel, her face scrunched up. "I will walk you to the bus stop," I offered. I had been indoor all day, reading. I needed to stretch my legs. Or perhaps I felt sorry for him, coming all the way for nothing. Or I might have sensed something intriguing about him, something unusual that maybe Gina had sensed as well, and for that reason had turned him away. The same thing that made her send him away had the opposite effect on me. It drew my attention. Right now he looked dejected, as if he had already made a budget for those €50, which he was now realizing he would never see. I asked him if he had ever sat for a painter before. He hadn't. Who had, apart from professional models? But he thought what she needed were ordinary people, real people. Wasn't he real enough? I walked ahead of Mark, down the stairs to the ground floor and out the door. My intention was to leave him at the bus stop and continue on across the road to the little lake where I sometimes went for a walk. But the bus was pulling away as we arrived, and I decided to wait for the next bus with him. And when the bus failed to come on time, he said he would go by foot. And on a whim, I said, "Let's walk."
Thank you for reading that for us. So my next question, I've got two interrelated questions. The first is, this novel, did you start working on this novel when you yourself were in Berlin? And then secondly, you'd mentioned previously that the book is made up out of, at least the raw material for the book is provided by real stories from people that you interviewed. Was it a choice? Did you ever think that this was going to be a nonfiction book, or were you already set on it being a fictional text? And why that choice?
Yeah, like I said, it's a book that I never planned to write. You know, it just kind of dropped in my lap because I had gone to Berlin in 2013 to write a different book, a novel. So I had the fellowship. It's called the DAAD Fellowship for 1 year. And when I went to Berlin, of course, I encountered all the migrants and their stories, and I felt compelled because the stories are so compelling. They are stories you can't listen and turn away. It's like seeing something that you cannot unsee, especially as a writer and as an African. So I felt that I wanted to write about them. And so I knew right away that I didn't want to write a non-fiction book. I wanted it to be fiction. I guess because it was kind of instinctive. It's not something that I kind of thought through, but in retrospect, I realized that I wanted to bring some imagination to this. It's not just about facts and figures, you know? Because the facts will tell you that these people are breaking the law. They're leaving their countries, and they deserve whatever, you know, they get. But you have to go beyond that. You have to try to understand, to bring a more kind of humane gaze, you know, to this scenario. So it's not as simple as the legality of it. So I had to, you know, you can only deal with that in fiction. You have to get your reader into the mind of these people. So I guess that's why I chose a fictional form to write about these people, and to also kind of to go beyond our everyday understanding and to step outside our comfort zones, our little bubbles. So I took this main character who is, you know, very comfortable in his bubble, and make him interact with these migrants. And eventually he begins to see that he is just like them. They are no different from him. And but for the grace of God, you know, he could be in their shoes. It's not something that we're all immune to. You could be sleeping in your room today, and tomorrow your country could be at war, and then you have to leave your hometown. And most of them, that's how it happened to them.
How did you deal with the burden of responsibility, I guess, of, I'm gathering that you'd sit with everyone, your tape recorder, you'd recorded these stories. And what kind of burden of responsibility did you feel? And what was the response to the people that you interviewed if you showed them the text along the way?
Yeah, quite a burden, definitely, because of the hope that you see in their eyes when they were talking to me, you know, that I saw. And the joy for them just to communicate, to be listened to, and you understand when you're talking to them that these are people who want to be heard, you know, who had been silenced and weren't listened to, and were just treated as, like I said, statistics and maybe non-human at all. And it was such a joy, a relief for them to be talking to me. And they wanted me to see them because they were not seen. So I realized that. At first, I was afraid that they might not want to talk to me because some of these things are so personal. And the paper, the newspapers sometimes make us feel as if it's a shameful thing for them to be doing this. Like I said, they were being criminalized in some way. But for them, it's no shame. The guy wanted me to understand that he was doing this for his daughter, for instance, the Somali storekeeper who had to escape Somalia because his daughter was going to be married off to some warlord. And I guess he wanted me to see him as he saw himself, as the world doesn't see him. And so I realized that burden that I was being given by them, you know, I had to make it perfect. I had to write, I had to translate, you know, that story and make it really, really as powerful as I could. So that was my biggest challenge. And it was daunting, but I guess I managed to convey it. And I was I didn't want to misrepresent them. I think that was my biggest fear. I didn't want to make them what they are not, you know? I didn't want to diminish them in any way. I wanted to maintain the integrity of the story. So I had to do that and at the same time make it interesting, make it not too political, because this is such a fraught political subject matter. And the worst thing you can do as a writer is to be too political. You don't want to preach to your reader, you know? So how did I, you know, how could I make it as political as it should be, you know, as topical, as urgent, but also make it entertaining and just a story that a reader would take and not put down? So that was the biggest challenge for me.
Are there any stories that didn't make it into the book, but that you think, wow, this is a great story, but you somehow just couldn't fit it into the book? And if you could share one or two of those stories, that would be really great.
Oh, yeah, there are quite a few. But one of the most interesting ones is the last chapter of this book, the one set in England. I almost didn't write it. You know, I got to a point where it was the hardest for me to write for so many reasons. I wanted to stop before that. I wanted to end the book where he left Europe and moved to Africa in that boat. That for me seemed like a perfect ending. Oh, he's, you know, because I wanted him to take the opposite direction from the migrants. The migrants are moving north. I want him to move south at the same time. So that was the whole trajectory for the book for me in terms of, you know, spatial movement. So for me, the moment he set foot in Africa, that I thought was, you know, should be the ending. And I guess I was trying to avoid the last chapter because I was just tired. But then I forced myself. And most people tell me that that's like the best chapter for them in the book, you know, the final chapter. So I'm glad that I ended up putting it in the book. There's another chapter, actually, that I didn't put in the book. A chapter that began in America, explaining how the main character met Gina, how he left Nigeria and moved to America, and how they got married. But I realized that, you know, that is a bit outside of my narrative, you know. It's like I'm explaining too much. So one, as a writer, you have to select, you have to know, no matter how beautiful the passage is, you have to decide if it belongs in the main narrative or if it doesn't belong. And I felt, I'm glad I didn't include it now. So that's one of the chapters that I didn't put in. And of course, there are other characters that I had to strike out of the book here and there.
The other question I wanted to ask you about was about the architecture of the novel. The novel itself is made up out of six interlinked narratives. And it begins first person, and then you think, okay, this is how we're going, and then it switches to third person. But just take us into your, it's so wonderfully woven together, and just take us into some of the thinking that went into that.
Yeah, I guess my instinct was that, you know, this has to be a multifocal kind of book. It's not just the story of one character, it's the story of all these people. And I started, you know, with the first person, and immediately I knew that I had to switch to the other characters. I have to bring them into the center as much as possible. The biggest challenge was, you know, I interviewed all these different people in different settings with different stories, different circumstances. And now how do I get these things all together as one, you know, narrative, as one coherent unit? And I didn't want to write just a book of short stories. I wanted it to be a novel. So I had to get at least the main character to find a way to interact with all these people, and he will be the kind of connecting tissue between all their stories. So it was quite a challenge to make him, you know, be in all these places like a magician and know all these people almost intimately, and to see them, for the reader to see them sometimes through his eyes. Sometimes he's an outsider. So it was quite a feat of juggling. But I wanted him at the beginning to be the one through whom we're introduced to the story. And I wanted to make a point with that, to kind of establish the fact that he's an outsider coming to Berlin, and then gradually the theme of being an outsider, trying to make a home in a new place, to see Berlin through an outsider's eyes. Because I knew that I couldn't write about Berlin as an insider. I was just there for 1 year. So it's important that we approach Berlin through the emotions of an outsider. And the emotion I wanted to capture was that of being away from home, of being a foreigner, of grappling with the language, to give you all these ideas of how a person, you know, might feel who is coming to this place from a different milieu. So that's why I chose him, and I chose that kind of beginning for the book. And then from there, it's just kind of natural. Everything is established, and the book just kind of flows along.
And one of the things that I love about the book is that it's filled with literary references to other books, The Lonely Londoners, T.S. Eliot, Nambuzo Marechera. Can you take us into your thinking behind that? And secondly, the other question I wanted to ask is, were there any books that were really important to you during the period of writing this novel, or that were fellow travelers, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, these writers that you mentioned, they were quite important to me. You know, while I was writing the book, I was reading them. And these are some of my favorite writers. They are writers that I have been reading, and I still read, you know, basically I come back to them, people like Nambuzo Marechera. And it's, you know, kind of intertextuality, you know, the subject of travel is not a new one. It's been one of the kind of most dominant themes in literature. And, you know, since the beginning of time, people have written about travel, and it's been approached in different ways. Traveling outside your hometown, you know, in prehistoric times was the most dangerous thing you could do. One of the biggest punishments you could get was to be cast out of your village, for instance. In some African communities, they didn't have the death penalty. What they had was exile, to be sent away from your known universe and cast out was the worst kind of punishment. And then it changed later, you know, with European adventurism and colonialism and all that. It's about conquest, how you go out. You become an adventurer, a hero, when you are able to travel outside your town, your country, and you come back and you are celebrated because you come with all these stories about distant places. And that's how colonialism basically worked. You go there as a conqueror. And there are all these texts about Westerners coming to Africa and conquering them. And then, of course, now you have Africans traveling. So what's the story from the African perspective? When it comes to us, it becomes criminal. You know? Oh, you're traveling illegally. The idea of being illegal suddenly emerges when it's our turn to travel. Because we were not meant to travel. You know, we were meant to stay in our countries that were created for us by the colonial powers. Very obedient servants, just to sit in your country. And you just have to sweat before you can get a visa. And you feel guilty, even just approaching the immigration table to present your passport, your green passport, they look at you. So it's about all these things that I was curious about. But reading all these texts while I was writing, I just wanted to touch on all these tropes of travel. And it made it kind of easier for me because I didn't have to reinvent the story of travel. It's already there. So by referencing them, I'm kind of in conversation with all these people who have written about Nambuzo Marechera living in England, you know, suffering in this environment that's really hostile to him. People like Matthew Arnold, who wrote about the beach, you know, Durba Beach, where he's there from England looking at France, where you have these migrant camps looking across the water at England. So there's this kind of, they're kind of gazing at each other, where Matthew Arnold is in England looking at France and the migrants in France are looking across the water at England. And I also mentioned T.S. Eliot when the main character is in the boat and they're crossing the Mediterranean and he's coming back to Africa and he's imagining all the dead people in the water. And then there's that line from T.S. Eliot.
On that note, may I please ask you to read just that section in particular, that one where the T.S. Eliot reference comes up?
So, yeah, that's the section where T.S. Eliot is basically saying, you know, I never knew death had undone so many. And, of course, it's not just from T.S. Eliot. It's also from Dante. It's from Divine Comedy that T.S. Eliot took that line and made it his own. And it's, for me, it just captures so powerfully. I never knew that death had undone so many. So here's the section. I lie on the bunk downstairs using the tiny backpack my tio gave me for a pillow. All my worldly possessions are in there. A pair of pants, some underwear, the book The Leopard by Tomasi di Lampedusa. I close my eyes, but I can't sleep. Under the engine sound, I could hear the susurration of the wind on the water. And soon I am on the deck, standing by the rail, watching the water. It is dark. The fog lies thickly over the water, and there is nothing to be seen but the inky black. I feel as if there is no deck under me. I'm standing over the water. And when I bend down, I see my reflection glowing up at me. My forehead glistens with sweat. I look terrified. A restless, writhing motion fills the water. Fish. A school of them is in a feeding frenzy. But when I bend closer, my face almost touching the water, I see they are not fish. They are human. Bodies floating face up, limbs thrashing, tiny hands reaching up to me. Hundreds of tiny hands, thousands of faces, until the surface of the water is filled with silent, ghostly eyes like lamps shining at me, and arms reaching up to be grasped. They float amidst a debris of floating belongings, toys, shoes, shirts, and family pictures, all slowly sinking into a bottomless Mediterranean. I drift past, and they drift past, and God drifts past, paring his nails. I pull back, tears on my face. I had not thought death had undone so many. I repeat the line over and over, rolling it over my tongue like a prayer, till my whisper turns to a scream. A hand on my shoulder is waking me. Wake up, Matteo says. We are here.
This is possibly one of the most haunting passages in the book. And, you know, in preparation for our conversation today, I'd just been, I'd read up a fact that 3,500 people drowned in the Mediterranean in 2014, the year that you were in Berlin, which is an astonishing number of people. And, and I think that, that passage that you read tries to contend with that horror.
Yeah. And you wonder how many bodies are there in the Mediterranean right now of young, you know, Africans who are just basically, who are lost to the nation and what they could have been if they had stayed, if things were different. And that's a tragedy that nobody talks about. You know, we just keep talking about illegal migrants and seeing their pictures in camps. We don't talk about the death and their potential, what they could have been, what they might have been. So it's crazy.
Absolutely. I think maybe just one final question. I think one of the things I was thinking about is that as much as The Travelers is also a novel about home and exile, it's also for me a book about the border or this concept of the border, which determines who here belongs and who is an outsider. And the insiders are worthy of our kindness or compassion. And then outsiders, we let them drown in the sea and we don't mourn their deaths. And I just wanted to know if, you know, just some final thoughts about the book, what you hope readers will get from it.
Yeah. I started talking about that earlier, that, you know, we need to reimagine what boundaries mean, you know, what travel means. And as a writer, I think that's what we're doing now. Most young African writers that don't just live in Africa, but travel internationally and live in foreign countries, and are not afraid to write about their travels, you know? I think we're beginning to challenge that idea of what the border is. It's not just a fixed place. We travel with our borders and our countries, you know, and we are, you know, you could be in America, but you're still South African. So basically you've moved a piece of South Africa with you, or Zimbabwean, you know, I could be in America and I've moved a piece of Nigeria with me. So borders have become mobile, have become more fluid, and the idea of fixed boundaries around people, you know, and containment has changed. Because borders in Africa are almost kind of carceral, you know, spaces where people are really confined. I think that was, imagine how it used to be where you could go to your neighbor's village on market day And then after colonialism, a line has been drawn and you cannot go to the next village of your cousins and brothers. Now you have to get a visa. So that idea of strict, unmovable borders and boundaries, I think that's what literature, new literatures, are beginning to challenge by writing about them, by transcending and reimagining the idea of boundaries and borders and belonging and not belonging, who is an outsider and who is an insider. I think that's a conversation we're going to be having for a long time, because travel is going to be one of the most defining features of our, of modern times. It's not going to end now. Right, it's just starting. People are going to keep traveling, and people are going to keep writing about travel. So that's, I think, very important.
One question I should have asked earlier, what did sitting with all of these people, interviewing them, writing this book, how did it change you? In what ways did it change you, if at all?
Yeah. I mean, every book you write as a writer changes you, because it's a journey that you took with the characters and being that close with them. They're basically inside your head, you know, for all these years. They're literally screaming inside your head. So it's inevitable that that will happen. But I think this book, more than any of my other books, has changed me, because you come face to face with injustice. You come face to face with suffering, you know, with human misery. And sometimes it brings into question, you know, people's humanity and why, how people can be so unaffected by what they see. And also you respect others who rise up to the occasion. Because I couldn't have written this book without the help of a lot of, you know, white Europeans who were my facilitators, who introduced me to these people and their NGO workers. And it shows the difference in response, you know, between peoples and how people, some people are just rising up to the occasion, and you respect that. So it, at the same time, reiterates and reinforces your faith in humanity. But also, at the same time, it makes you question how people can be so inhumane. So there's all of that. But unfortunately, as a writer, you're supposed to be distant. You're supposed not to get too involved with your subject matter, because then you are stuck, you know? It makes you incapable of moving on to the next book, because basically it handicaps you. Too much empathy. Sometimes it's not good. But you are changed, whether you like it or not. So I feel that I've been changed, and it's been privileged to be able to talk about these people. When I sat down to write the book, I was talking to my editor, and one of the questions he asked me, do you really want to write this book? Because it's so topical, and there are so many books that have been written on this subject matter. I said, no, I feel that this is my take on this. An artist wouldn't say that he's not going to draw a tree because other artists have drawn trees before. This is going to be my tree. This is going to be the way I see this. So I bring all my understanding and my experience of travel and pain and being an outsider, and I try to use it to reimagine the lives of these people and this story. So that is also a part of me.
Thank you so much again, Helen. And I think from my side, the last thing I'll say is this is definitely a book that, as readers, will not leave us unchanged. And thank you so much again for your time, for coming to chat with us, and wish you all the best. And
thank you.
More travels.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Travelers is available for sale at the Book Lounge. In the next episode of the Open Book podcast series, Efemia Chela moderates a conversation between Bettina Gupper, Zoe Wickham, and Helen Moffat, which will be out on Thursday. This podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, the Heinrich Bull Foundation. The Heinrich Bull Foundation has been actively promoting the consolidation of democracy and human rights, advancing gender equality, and taking action to prevent the destruction of the environment in Southern Africa since 1989. The Foundation's work in Southern Africa consists of four programs: democracy and social justice, human rights and gender justice, sustainable development, and international politics and dialogue. Thanks to our excellent producer, Andy Burnett. As always, I'm Fasti Collins, listening with you to the Open Book podcast series.